Decade, Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, after arranging a secret meeting with Taliban leaders, President Trump canceled talks to end the 18-year war. We'll get the latest on the conflict, why discussions fell apart, and what could happen next. First, here's a question you probably get a lot. How are you doing? It's probably one of the first things you say when you're doing something like getting lunch with a friend. But our next guest says too often we don't really want to hear honest answers to that question. And for that matter, we probably don't even know what the honest answer is for ourselves. Mark Brackett is the founding director of the Yale Center for Emotional Intelligence and a professor at the Child Study Center at Yale University. His new book is Permission to Feel, Unlocking the Power of Emotions to Help Our Kids, Ourselves, and Our Society Thrive. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Well, you write in your book that this is a personal subject for you. How did you, growing up, and your family struggle with emotions?
Well, I struggled from a lot of bullying in my childhood, and people didn't recognize that it was happening. And I was uncomfortable talking about it for a variety of reasons. One was my mom was an anxious person, and so she would be like, oh my goodness, I can't believe what's happening. And my father was a tough guy who just wanted me to be a tough guy. So I learned very early, guess what? Don't share.
And this is a recurring theme in your book, this idea that our inability to deal with emotions, we'll get into that more, it can be intergenerational. We could pass it down to our kids. And the struggle, it seems like, that you're dealing with is how do we break that cycle?
That's true. I mean, oftentimes I just turned 50 and we take a look back and we say, wait a minute, how did I just become like my mom or like my dad, right?
And you say a lot of us don't really know how we feel at any given moment. We don't even have a radar to assess our own emotions. Why is that?
I think it's because we have not received an adequate emotion education. Think about it. You know, how much training do any of us get in building a comprehensive emotion vocabulary? Not many of us have gotten that. And therefore, you know, when people ask us how we're feeling, what do we say? Fine, busy. And the expectation is that we just move on.
One problem that you run into, and you talk about the objections you hear when you train people like school administrators in emotions, there's a lot of resistance to the idea that we should be dealing with emotions. Sometimes we think of emotions as something we should overcome. It's a virtue to rise above our emotions. It's not just that we don't know, it's that we sometimes don't even wanna, right?
Well, emotions are scary for a lot of people. You know, it's hard to talk about our difficult feelings like anxiety and shame, you know, and frustration and all those so-called negative emotions because people think people who experience those feelings are weak. And a big part of my book is saying, no, emotions are information. And if someone is feeling anxiety or fear or shame, that means we need to attend to it and teach them how to manage it effectively.
What is the harm that you see in society of our difficulties with emotions? What's the damage it's doing to us?
Well, the emotions that we have to go somewhere. So you think about how many students now have anxiety disorders. You know, in Connecticut alone, at our universities and colleges, there's been a 20% increase each year for the last 5 years in students seeking treatment for mental health. Depression is the leading cause of disability worldwide. So there's the mental health consequences. And then there's the physical health consequences from, you know, having heart disease to other physical illnesses as a result of not having effective strategies to manage our feelings.
Talking to psychologist Mark Brackett, his new book is called Permission to Feel, Unlocking the Power of Emotions to Help Our Kids, Ourselves, and Our Society Thrive. A key to your argument, Mark, is the idea that we're not doomed to have the emotional makeup that we grew up with. We can change it. And that might be a surprise to a lot of people. Can we learn a different emotional blueprint?
We can. And the good news is that it is never too early or too late to learn the skills of emotional intelligence. We can always become better at recognizing our own feelings and those of other people, you know, asking the questions to understand why we have our feelings and what caused them, building our emotional vocabulary, learning how to express emotions to get our needs met. And the big one is there's always an opportunity to try better strategies to regulate your feelings.
And you've got a multi-step approach. The acronym is RULER, R-U-L-E-R. I want to get at least into a few of those steps. And step one is something you were just talking about. Recognize is the first R. Walk us through how we can get better at recognizing our own emotions in the first place.
The first is to pay attention to your brain and your body, right? So do I feel pleasant? Do I feel unpleasant? And just making an estimate of like how pleasant you are in that moment. And then the second is paying attention to your energy levels. Am I really energized? Am I feeling tired and depleted? And those are indicators of how you're feeling. And then you can say, well, all right, my pleasantness is high, but my energy is low. Okay, I'm feeling calm. I'm feeling content. Or my pleasantness is very low and my energy is high. Oh, I'm feeling anxious or angry. And then the last two skills, the E and the R of RULER, has to do with, all right, what am I going to do with this feeling? Well, how do I want to feel? Who can I talk to about my emotions? And importantly, what are the strategies? Am I going to do something physical, like take a run or do some exercise to manage my feelings? Or am I going to do something cognitively, meaning change my self-talk? Instead of saying, I hate my life and I'm never going to be good at this, reframe it and say, you know what? People make mistakes. This is temporary. I can learn this.
I want to set aside RULER now, this kind of five-stage process for a moment, and talk about the value of doing what you just said. You point out, let's take school, for example. We're at back-to-school time now. How important are emotions when it comes to, say, a student's ability to learn?
Well, the best example I have is my own, because I was a terrible student. I was a C and D student, for example, in middle school. And it was because I was a very anxious kid. I was a fearful kid. I was hopeless. And when you're feeling strong emotions like that and you're not taught how to manage them effectively, guess what? It's really hard to learn. And importantly, if your school is a place where children in general feel unsafe or feel disrespected, it's hard to learn in those contexts. And what we say is that emotions are the drivers of student learning and engagement.
And you've heard, you write about objections, again, from school administrators and teachers and others you've worked with, that, hey, our goal here is to teach students, to get them to perform well on things like standardized tests. It's not our role to deal with the individual emotions of each student. What would you say to them?
I would say that their own lives and the lives of every one of the students are saturated with emotions from the moment they wake up in the morning until the end of the day, right? If a kid is at home and parents are going through a divorce and they're witnessing their parents fighting all the time, and then it is dropped off to school after witnessing that, they're going to be activated. And unless that child is in a safe and caring classroom, and unless that child learns strategies to manage their stress, they're not going to be the best possible learner they could be.
Have you seen, say, a school do something about this, take the RULER approach and actually make a difference for their kids by taking emotions head on?
So RULER is our center's approach to teaching social and emotional learning. We're in 2,000 schools across the United States and in other countries, and we've seen just tremendous results from schools taking this work seriously. We've seen less student anxiety, less student stress, less teacher burnout, less bullying, greater engagement, and even greater academic performance when schools take this work seriously.
We're talking to Mark Brackett, psychologist at the Child Study Center at Yale University. We're talking about his latest book. It's called Permission to Feel, Unlocking the Power of Emotions to Help Our Kids, Ourselves, and Our Society Thrive. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we have an emotion problem in our society? Do we not take emotional intelligence seriously enough? How are you raised, if you're willing to talk about this, to deal with your emotions, if at all? Do you feel like you got any kind of emotion education? Have you made breakthroughs in your life, learning how to assess how you're feeling and what to do if you don't like how you're feeling? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our conversation with Mark Brackett, founding director of the Yale Center for Emotional Intelligence and professor at Yale's Child Study Center. We're talking about strategies for learning and sharpening emotional intelligence, why it's important for our mental and physical well-being. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What does emotional intelligence mean to you? Do you feel like you were brought up to be in touch with your emotions, to understand them, and to have tactics for dealing with them when you didn't like the direction they were taking you in? Have you worked with some kind of emotion training in a school or workplace setting? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to our callers now. Peter is with us in Viroqua. Peter, hi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What do you want to tell us about, Peter?
Well, before the break, it sounded like you wanted to hear from somebody that, like myself, I grew up in a family where there was not much emotional education at all. And so basically, I was told not to complain about pain or feelings, and so I stuffed a lot of emotions, and that became my pattern at a very early age. And then I, at about sixth grade, I recognized that I was just basically full of rage. And so much of my adolescence and into my 20s and 30s was just trying to control that rage in any way I could, and it ended up being in a lot of unhealthy ways. I'm recovering from multiple addictions, and I've had all sorts of health challenges, like recovery from cancer, and I've had heart issues and asthma, for instance. And so now my work is with ACEs and understand the effect of adverse childhood experiences on health, mental and physical health. And I've got a job where I'm going into the schools and I'm working with children. I'm a former elementary teacher, and I'm working with children on this education around emotional and child intelligence. So I think it's just wonderful that you are bringing this up and it's part of the program today.
Peter, thank you so much for sharing your story. Peter, not alone with that experience. Mark, his story's got to sound pretty familiar to you.
It does. You know, I hear stories like his all the time. And, you know, this gets back to the idea that, you know, the adults who are raising kids, the adults who are teaching kids, have to learn these skills first, because then they can be the role models for our nation's youth.
Peter, thanks so much for sharing that story. And Mark, this, if we don't deal with our emotions, if we stuff them down, as Peter found, that can lead to rage, angry outbursts. Is that, just even knowing that, is that something that can help, say, teachers and principals, like trying to understand why a kid might be angry, apparently from a teacher's perspective, out of nowhere?
It is. I mean, I think what's important to know is also that behavior is not feeling, you know, so a kid may be yelling and screaming and look like they're angry, but they might be feeling deep shame inside. And so that goes to the point of building relationships, right? We've got to know our children. We've got to know our students, and we've got to make talking about feelings common and comfortable, because again, these students are coming to school with feelings. And if we don't address them, they're going to interfere with learning, and can lead to unfortunate circumstances like we just heard.
Peter, thanks again for calling. We'll go now to Taj in Monona, Iowa. Taj, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, just as a man in today's society and working in the construction business, you know, it isn't always viewed as an asset to have a wide range of emotions, and as someone who does and feels like they're pretty in touch with their emotional side, it's just frustrating trying to communicate with someone who doesn't have the same emotional toolbox you do. So I guess what would be some advice you would have on doing that in a more like male-oriented career and, you know, business sector?
Taj, thanks for calling in with that question. Mark, any thoughts?
You know, it's interesting. In, you know, the corporate world, there's a little bit more resistance to this oftentimes in the business world, and especially among men. You know, I remember being in a company recently, and one of the managers said to me, "You're expecting us to go around the table and share how we're feeling?" And I said, "Kind of." You know, I think it takes the courage of one person, like our caller, to do that. And again, you have to be sensitive to your context. But most people, when given the opportunity, you know, are pretty comfortable doing it. And I think oftentimes it just takes one person to say, you know, hey, how's it going? You know, I got to let you know. Like, be the role model. You know, like, I had a rough weekend. And do it in a way that makes sense to your colleagues. Obviously, you know, you don't want it to feel too, quote unquote, touchy-feely because, you know, that can be a turnoff. But do it in the way that you think would be, you know, opening for them.
Taj, thanks a lot for the call. Hope that helps. We're talking to Mark Brackett. His new book is called, Permission to Feel, Unlocking the Power of Emotions to Help Our Kids, Ourselves, and Our Society Thrive. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Sarah is with us now in Waukesha. Sarah, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Sarah?
I was just listening. I've never called into a radio before, so it's the first time. But it just kind of struck me because it's really important how it affected my life. I grew up without really being able to show negative emotions. So I think the way I reacted to it, I started cutting my arms and my neck when I was about 15. And I don't cut anymore. I've gone through lots of therapy, but I know it's becoming more and more of a trend with young kids. I don't know if it's just because they're not being able to express their emotions very well.
Sarah, thank you so much for sharing that story and making that first call to our show. I appreciate it. Mark, a very physical sign of the damage of not being able to cope with, as Sarah said, negative emotions.
You know, it is, and I'm sorry that you had to experience that, and way too many kids do that. You know, this is why, you know, it's so important for our parents to be open to learning these skills and to be good listeners of their children, because our feelings have to go somewhere. For me, they went into an eating disorder, into self-hatred. For others, into cutting. For others, into aggression and violence. They come out, you know, in one form or another. And I think what's so important is that we teach children that it's okay to have all feelings, and importantly, create context where they can talk about them and learn strategies to regulate them effectively.
Yeah, and Sarah talked about negative emotions, and you know, negative emotions, we feel bad about them. We don't want to be angry or sad. So it seems like we might be resistant to experiencing them or acknowledging them. What is the healthier way to deal with the bad stuff?
Well, I think we have to remove the language, you know, about bad or good. So all emotions are information. You know, for example, I'm angry at our nation's education system to a great extent because people aren't taking this work seriously enough. So that anger is what motivates me. Now, I don't run around screaming at politicians and yelling at people. I try to channel my anger into building great curriculum and doing powerful presentations to show the science so that schools take this work seriously. So you can see it's not the anger itself that's good or bad. It's how we use that anger, whether we use it wisely or we use it in a destructive way.
Sarah, thanks again for the call. Jim joins us now in Watertown. Jim, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call. A little history. I grew up down south in a pretty redneck community, short kid, and then ended up being the captain of my wrestling team through high school, and then ended up doing 14 years in the penitentiary, all of which you could not show emotions. Anything, you know, weak. What I want to say is that here in the last 10 years, my emotions are pretty much out of control. They're heavy swings, either no emotions or way too severe emotions. If you do not learn to deal with your emotions as a kid, they will come back to haunt you later. This is something that should be taught, you know, some way, whether it's school or getting counseling as, you know, as a normal for kids. It should be a something that's thought of as absolute and necessary.
Jim, wow. Thank you so much for sharing your story. Sorry you went through that. Mark, what do you think of when you hear Jim talk about his life experience?
Yeah, I'm really sorry that you had to go through all that. And I agree with you wholeheartedly. I don't think it should just be in counseling, because what happens is that when we wait until you're in counseling, you know, you've already had all these experiences that led to that. So that's why I believe firmly that this should be what we call primary prevention, or tier one, it's called in schools. Like, everybody gets this training from preschool all the way to high school, so that it's just part of the curriculum, not something that's just for the students who are acting out.
Thanks again for the call, Jim. Mark, what would your advice be to people out there listening and thinking, yeah, this is me, I'm not really on top of my emotions, I don't know, I don't really dig deep into them? What are some first steps you'd recommend people take?
Well, in my book, what I talk about is just giving yourself that permission to feel. Just shifting your mindset that emotions are useful, they're valuable, as opposed to something that should be suppressed or ignored or denied. That's step one. The second is what I talk about in my book, is how to become an emotion scientist. How do you become curious about feelings? Like, start looking at people's facial expressions and saying, oh, I wonder how they're feeling right now. Start paying attention to your own, you know, body and your own mind. You know, how am I feeling right now? Build your emotion vocabulary. Like, push yourself to not say fine or okay. Like, you know, think about more elaborate words. Are you peeved? Are you angry? Are you enraged? Are you down? Are you disappointed? Are you feeling despair? Are you content? Are you elated? Are you ecstatic? Like, get more granular in your words. Talk about your feelings more to people that you care about. And then finally, practice basic strategies. Some are just breathing exercises to help us, you know, downregulate or calm down. And then importantly, what I think is one of the most critical strategies is monitoring our negative self-views and negative self-talk, and just finding ways to engage in more positive self-talk.
It's a good place to leave it, Mark. Thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's Mark Brackett with Yale's Child Studies Center and the Center for Emotional Intelligence. His new book, we've been talking about it, it's called Permission to Feel, Unlocking the Power of Emotions to Help Our Kids, Ourselves, and Our Society Thrive. Thanks to you for all your calls as well. Coming up after the news, we'll turn our focus to Afghanistan, after a secret meeting aimed at bringing about an end to the war there fell apart over the weekend. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, biologists with the DNR took on reintroduction of trumpeter swans to our state 3 decades ago. We'll find out how successful the effort has been. Now we're learning more about a secret meeting that was to have been held over the weekend between President Trump and leaders of the Taliban at Camp David. Word came out when the president tweeted Saturday night that he was canceling talks to bring an end to the 18-year war. He said he scrapped discussions after the Taliban took responsibility for an attack last week that killed 12 people, including a U.S. soldier. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was on CNN yesterday. He was asked about hosting an organization that still supports the 9/11 attacks that killed 3,000 people.
We understand who the Taliban are. There's no more clear-eyed administration. When I was the director of the CIA, I had young men and women serving in Afghanistan, taking enormous risk to their lives. We're aiming to get this right. We're working to talk with those leaders that can actually deliver on these outcomes. That's what President Trump and I are both focused on, and we're going to keep driving towards that outcome.
So given that the peace talks are apparently shut down, what happens next? Nick Wadhams is a State Department reporter for Bloomberg. Nick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, nobody other than those immediately involved seem to know about this idea of a meeting between the president and Taliban leaders at Camp David. What do we know about it now that the president has tweeted about it?
Well, the meeting is off, and it looks like negotiations between the U.S. and the Taliban are at a total standstill now. The Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, has not ruled out the possibility that the U.S. will withdraw troops from Afghanistan even without an agreement from the Taliban, but right now this negotiating process that had been going on for nearly a year looks to be completely frozen.
Talk about this idea and what we know about it from within the White House. Was this the president himself, key staffers? Where did this idea of this Camp David meeting come from?
Everything we've heard so far is that this was the president's idea, and this fits with his own past penchant for a love of grand gestures and personal diplomacy. He did it with the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. He's talked about doing it with Iranian leaders. And what we had heard was that there was a deal that was very close to fruition. There might be a few what the State Department called technical details that still needed to be worked out. And it was the president's idea. He said, hey, let's bring them in. I'll bring them to Camp David. I can look the Taliban in the eye, and we can get this thing done. As far as we know, that idea was pretty vehemently opposed by the president's national security advisor, John Bolton, and a lot of folks on his staff. And in subsequent interviews, Mike Pompeo made clear that the decision to bring the Taliban to Camp David had been the president's decision. So it looked from those comments like he was distancing himself just a little bit from that decision.
And we've seen at least a couple of congressional Republicans unhappy of this about this idea of the Taliban being at Camp David, especially as they indicated so close to the September 11th attack anniversaries. What are we hearing from the president's own party?
Well, there was widespread discontent, both about two things. One was the idea of bringing the Taliban to Camp David. You know, after all, they had sheltered Osama bin Laden after 9/11, refused to give him up, and had publicly declared their support for the 9/11 attacks. So the optics of that obviously were horrible. But more broadly, you had seen this rising swell of discontent, even among the president's most close supporters in the Republican Party, about the idea of this agreement that looked like it was coming out. They were very uneasy with the idea of the U.S. trusting the Taliban to live up to what the U.S. was seeking, which would be commitments to guarantee that terrorist groups would not be allowed to thrive on Afghan soil.
Talking to Nick Wadhams, national security reporter at Bloomberg, looking at negotiations in Afghanistan, an idea floated by the president soon canceled, a Camp David meeting between the president and Taliban leaders. Nick, you mentioned that deal that's been in the works. What does each side, the U.S. and the Taliban, offer in what we understand to be the latest version of this deal?
So the plan was, as outlined by the U.S. Envoy who was negotiating this, was that the U.S. would bring down, withdraw about 5,000 of the 14,000 troops it's maintained in Afghanistan within about a half a year. And in exchange for that, the Taliban would guarantee that it would not allow terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda or ISIS to gain traction on Afghan soil. The idea from there was that there would begin a dialogue between the Taliban and the Afghan government, which so far has been almost completely cut out from this negotiating process, and they would work together to form some sort of coalition or future government, pave the way for elections and things like that. The concern was always that the U.S. would come to this agreement on withdrawing troops and getting those security guarantees from the Taliban, and then essentially turn things over, and once it pulled out troops, the Taliban, which already controls a large swath of the country, would not take up that dialogue with the Afghan government, which it calls a stooge of the United States. So that's really where these talks foundered.
And that's a big deal, that this is the U.S. and the Taliban, not the Afghan government itself, which exists. How do they feel? How do Afghan leaders feel about not being at these negotiations about the future of their country?
Deeply unsettled, angry, I mean, you name it, furious. This was a huge problem with these talks and was the source of a great deal of skepticism for whether or not they would work. And you only have to see the reaction so far from the Afghan government now that the talks have foundered. It's a sense of relief and almost satisfaction. They were deeply, deeply uneasy. The president had called the Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani, to come to the U.S. to be at these talks at Camp David with the Taliban. But really, the Afghan government's presence there would have been almost entirely symbolic. The negotiations that have been going on so far have gone on exclusively between the U.S. and Taliban, with absolutely no Afghan government role. So they were deeply uneasy about being shut out, and also deeply skeptical that the Taliban would live up to any commitment to negotiate with them once the U.S. Cleared out in terms of its own negotiations.
And currently in Afghanistan, there's not a ceasefire or anything, right, between the Taliban and the government. We're seeing Taliban attacks fairly big ones and fairly routinely, aren't we?
That's right. Suicide bombings and other attacks continue. And the Taliban's own hold on various parts of the country only continues to increase. And, I mean, it should be noted that this was the sort of proximate reason that the president gave for why he had called this off just a day or so before an American soldier was killed in an attack that the Taliban took credit for. But those attacks have continued for weeks and months. I think 15 or 16 American troops have been killed so far this year in Afghanistan, and the number of civilians and Afghan soldiers who have been killed there is in the thousands. And this was one of the big concerns from the Afghan government. They wanted a ceasefire, and the Taliban had so far refused to commit to taking that step.
Now, this is not a new issue. The George W. Bush administration was trying to figure out what an endpoint in Afghanistan would look like. The Barack Obama administration, same deal. What is it that's making this such an intractable problem for American leaders?
Well, the big question is, okay, we put troops over in Afghanistan very shortly after September 11th to push the Taliban from power, to punish them essentially for giving shelter to Osama bin Laden. That was then achieved, but the Afghan government has never been able to stand up on its own two feet. And in the years since, the security situation has only worsened in Afghanistan. U.S. troop numbers have fallen from their peak to about 14,000 now. But you have a situation where if the U.S. pulls out those troops, there's a very real possibility that the Afghan government would collapse, the Taliban would return and take almost complete control of the country, and all the gains, limited as they may be, that were gotten from September 11th would be almost completely erased. What would be the status of women, of minorities in Afghanistan, for example, and what would happen to that government? There's a lot of concern that it would just be immediately ejected from office. But the Taliban has a great deal of power. I mean, when you go to Afghanistan now, it is extremely insecure. U.S. officials travel around almost exclusively by helicopter in armored cars. The security situation is very, very grave now.
Can you talk about this as an agenda item, a political item for President Trump? He made the case that he would succeed where others had failed in bringing home American troops from Afghanistan. He's put a lot of stock in his deal-making ability to settle problems, as you mentioned, not just in Afghanistan. How important is this for the president?
Well, I think it's certainly he has wanted to fulfill a promise he made on the campaign trail, which was that the U.S. for years under successive Democratic and Republican administrations had gotten into overseas wars and risked and sacrificed the lives of American troops for no gain, and that he wanted to bring those troops home. And indeed, that's sort of one of the big issues here that has caused a lot of concern. It's essentially that the president wants to get U.S. troops home no matter the cost, and wants to fulfill that promise, and that these negotiations, according to some of his critics, are really just a cover for him to be able to bring those troops home. But you do also see the president really looking for a win in the foreign policy sphere. He's sought to roll out this brand of personal diplomacy, big gestures, on all sorts of issues, and there has yet to be real progress in any of them. It should be noted, of course, that past administrations also weren't able to make a lot of progress on issues like North Korea, for example. But when the president inserts himself into these negotiations directly, he says, I alone can fix it, he meets with Kim Jong-un, for example, then it sort of, in the end, the responsibility for the failure of those negotiations in some ways falls to him directly, because he said he's so important to that process. So you're seeing that reckoning happening a bit now with Afghanistan as well.
And Nick, you mentioned Camp David is off. Talks are apparently postponed. What are you watching for next?
Well, the big thing will be what happens to the U.S. envoy, the former ambassador to Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad. He is the State Department envoy tasked with these negotiations. He is now on his way back to the United States from Doha, where he was negotiating with the Taliban. What does he do next? What is his next step? The situation is almost completely frozen. The big thing I will be looking out for is what happens to U.S. troops. Secretary of State Pompeo was asked repeatedly yesterday on various news shows, what would happen? Will the U.S. pull out troops even without agreement on a peace deal? And he would not answer that question. He left that option wide open. He refused to say no, the U.S. would keep all of its forces there. So the big question now will be, what preparations are underway? Does the president just want to get U.S. troops out even without a peace deal with the Taliban?
Nick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Nick Wadhams is a national security reporter with Bloomberg. We talked to him about President Trump's decision to cancel a secret meeting between Afghan and Taliban leaders at Camp David. Coming up, we'll learn about a 30-year effort to reestablish trumpeter swans here in Wisconsin. Find out more coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new report finds that the University of Wisconsin-Madison is one of the most affordable large public universities in the country, but may fall behind at bringing low-income students onto campus. We'll find out more coming up. First, if you hear this. It means that North America's largest waterfowl is nearby. It's a trumpeter swan. They're big birds stretching to 6 feet in length and weighing more than 25 pounds. Seeing them is memorable, but a few decades ago, you couldn't have done it here in Wisconsin. They were regular residents of the state generations ago, but they disappeared pretty much completely more than a century ago. 30 years ago, though, an ambitious reintroduction project was launched to bring the trumpeters back to Wisconsin, and the two people here in the studio with me were a big part of that effort. Randy Jerwitz is a retired wildlife ecologist and administrator with the Bureau of Endangered Resources at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Randy, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Rob.
And Sumner Madison is an avian ecologist and works within the DNR's Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation. Sumner, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Well, give us the story of why they disappeared, Randy, the trumpeter swan, from Wisconsin.
Sure. Well, back in the 1600s, there were as many as 130,000 east of the Rockies. And unfortunately, their numbers were decimated due to the market gunning and millinery trade. Skins were ground into powder puffs, and feathers were used to adorn fashionable women's hats. So the numbers depleted rapidly. Between 1823 and 1837, actually 1877, there were as many as 108,000 skins that were sold in Europe. Even John James Audubon preferred trumpeter swan skills to all others for his fine detail sketches. So that by 1932, we only had about 69 in the entire continental U.S. And these were birds primarily in an area called the Tri-State, southwestern Montana, east-central Idaho, and northwestern Wyoming. So we had a rather serious situation with ourselves regarding the recovery of the species.
Now bring us to 1989 or the late 1980s and the effort, the decision to try to bring trumpeters back to Wisconsin.
Well, it was one of those tough decisions. We had just received legislative authority to have an endangered resources fund in Wisconsin, funded by an income tax checkoff. And so we needed to, you know, your highway dollars at work, we needed to have a project that people could see, you know, what we were doing with their money, a showy project, and yet one that was ecologically meaningful. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was controlling the supply of whooping crane eggs. That was one of the first things we thought of. For a project in Florida, developing a non-migratory flock down there. The next biggest, showy, and very ecologically meaningful project that we could come up with was to reintroduce trumpeter swans to Wisconsin, following in the footsteps of Minnesota, because they had already gone to Alaska, gotten eggs, and proved that it could be successful.
And so that took you to Alaska, out in the wild, collecting surplus, as much as possible, trumpeter swan eggs. Could you talk about what that was like?
Sure. We always had to leave at least two good eggs in a nest under Fish and Wildlife Service protocol. So we had quite a bit of experience beforehand trying to figure out if an egg was viable or not, because we didn't have any wild stock in Wisconsin. So I had to go to game farms across the state and learn how to candle eggs to see the difference between a viable egg and a non-viable egg. And with that experience, also with a number of manuals that I consulted, we were on our way in 1989.
And then we've got eggs in Wisconsin, and we're hatching them. How did it happen?
Well, it was a real whirlwind. Terry Kohler flew us up to Alaska on June 5th. We left Wisconsin June 5th, 1989. We got to Alaska that day. We collected the next day, June 6th, and then Terry said he slept over, during the day, and he flew us back to Wisconsin overnight. Because
wow.
We were carrying these eggs in suitcases with hot water bottles. Low-tech, but effective. But the timing was very, very tight. So Terry Kohler, God rest his soul, flew us home overnight, and we arrived in Milwaukee the next morning. The eggs were then transported to the Milwaukee County Zoo, and they incubated them.
Wow.
But the actual collection was quite interesting that first year, because I didn't know it at the time, but I had an inner ear condition, so that I quickly became quite airsick.
Oh, no.
And for 13 hours, I was in difficult straits. And at one point, Rod King turned to me and he said, "Madison, you're not going to expire on me, are you?" So it was quite a challenge. I soldiered on, and we collected up to 60 eggs that year.
Wow. Well, from humble beginnings, I want to jump now to where we are, because this, I think we can call this a success story, right? What do we see with Trumpeter Swans in Wisconsin today?
It was a great success story.
Yeah, we have actually three populations of Trumpeter Swans in North America for management purposes. We have the Rocky Mountain population, Pacific Coast population, and what's called the interior population, which is made up of restoration flocks. As of the last North American Trumpeter Swan Survey, there were 27,000 in the interior population, 12,000 in the Rocky Mountain population, and 24 in the Pacific Coast population, for a total of 63,000. Now, we have currently in Wisconsin about 6,000 birds. Our recovery goal, our recovery objective, was 20 breeding and migratory pairs by the year 2000. And for a while, between 1997 and 2000, we were lingering at about 17 or 18 pairs, and that took off in the year 2000. We had 44 that year, and since then it's been a straight climb almost to the present number.
And Randy, do you see a success story like this maybe being an inspiration, maybe a guidepost to other restoration efforts for birds or other species?
Well, it has been. Iowa, following our success, has gotten into Trumpeter Swan restoration. It certainly built a lot of credibility with the people of Wisconsin, who continue to donate on the Wisconsin income tax form, to the Endangered Resources Fund. Obviously, they think that the department is doing good things with their money.
And Sumner, what's it like for you, having been at this from the beginning, when you actually see, or in many cases, I guess, hear a trumpeter in the wild in Wisconsin?
It's extremely gratifying, very rewarding. And I should say that no single individual has been responsible for the success. It's really been a team effort, many public and private partnerships that have made this all possible.
And where, if people want to see and hear trumpeters in Wisconsin today, where are the sweet spots to catch them?
So probably the largest concentration is up in the northwestern part of the state. The Crex Meadows Wildlife Area is a great place for people to go. In the central part of the state, the Sand Hill Wildlife Area is also a very good place to go.
And we've got just a few moments. Do you want to give a shout-out to some of the other partners involved in this process, or name a couple names before we let you go?
Milwaukee County Zoo, where they hatched all the eggs that we brought back.
Wow.
The Natural Resources Foundation has been absolutely instrumental in providing funding to this program. And we've had just a variety of public and private partnerships that have made this all successful.
All right.
And definitely, got to add, Mary and Terry Kohler, who flew us up there. Terry flew the plane. Mary made the coffee and kept him awake. So without them, we wouldn't have been it.
Fantastic. Well, thank you both so much for sharing the story today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Been talking to Randy Jerwitz and Sumner Madison. Sumner's an avian biologist with the DNR. Randy retired from the DNR, talking about the successful three-decade effort to restore trumpeter swans here in Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it can be hard to get kids to read. There's a lot of competing activities, some fun and healthy, getting outside and playing, some, you know, the screen time, things like that. We're going to talk to the author of a new book about how to raise a reader, how to raise a kid who loves reading. And we want your stories now. We've got a spot up on the Ideas Network Facebook page. A lot of people actually already sharing their stories. We have some questions for you. If you're a reader now, what led you there? Was there something, a parent, a teacher who got you into reading, who helped bring a love of reading into your life? Did you stumble across it yourself somewhere along the way? On the other end of the equation, if you are a parent yourself, what has worked? What hasn't worked? Has it come and gone? Has it been a struggle? Share your story of growing up as a reader or not, and trying to raise a kid who loves to read. Do that over at the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. I got into reading a lot as a kid, kind of because I was a sickly kid and I didn't have anything better to do. I don't recommend that as a strategy, though. We'll find out your answers again tomorrow on Central Time with the author of How to Raise a Reader. Stick around. More to come here on the Ideas Network.